Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, Jasmine Paris returns to the show to talk about her historic finish and overall experience at the 2024 Barkley Marathons. Before we get started, though, I'd like to give thanks to Rabbit, our official apparel partner. You can use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout on their website for 20% off your next order there. I'd also like to thank our nutrition partner, NAC. One of the aspects of NAC that I really appreciate is their commitment to making the most sustainable sports nutrition products on the market. As a certified B Corp, they're doing a lot to reduce pollution and use fewer resources in their supply chain. And one of the coolest bits of news to share is that by next year, 100% of their packaging will be reusable, recyclable, or compostable. Pretty cool leadership on the environmental front. If you're curious to try their products, which taste great and work great, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout on their website for 15% off your next order. With that, let's get to the conversation with Jasmine Paris. All right, Jasmine Paris, it is great to have you back on the Single Track Podcast. We are overjoyed by your historic Barkley finish. How are you doing a couple days removed from the event?
I'm great. Yeah, I'm great. Thanks. I'm recovering well. Back on clinics today. So it's kind of getting back into normal life again. Just a cool. Bit of tendonitis left. But otherwise, yeah, I was a bit late for work, so I had to run from the last bit. And yeah, it was good. Felt pretty good.
Cool. Well, yeah, there's a lot of media out there on your story. We'll make sure to link to a lot of it in the show notes. Where I actually want to start this conversation is with your kit, you know, your gear for the event. I happened to be on the ground for it, so it was easier to see, but kind of like in a sea of state-of-the-art swag for most runners, I noticed patches on your shoes. I think you were wearing like an out-of-production Ultimate Direction pack. You had some dated shirts and pants. What's the story behind how you kitted up for this race?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm very much a believer in the kind of trying to make kit last as long as you can. The bag isn't actually even mine. It was a friend's bag that I've used last year for Barkley and it worked for me. So I asked if I could borrow it again rather than buying a new pack. I've got my own, but it just doesn't work that well for a race like Barkley. Those shoes have actually run both. Like they'd run three Barclays. It's just that I happened to have that pair of shoes. I had a few other pairs of because I was kind of sponsored by a brand for a while and got sent quite a few pairs of shoes. So I'd sort of had various shoes and these were the ones that I first ran Barkley in, and then I sort of cleaned them and put them in the cupboard. And so they sort of they went through each set. And this time I realized not that long before I was going to go that they had kind of slight defects. So I actually sewed them up and then patched them using the kind of instructions that are on the Green Runners website in terms of kind of gluing patches over them, and they lasted fine for the I actually put on a separate pair for the fifth loop, but that was more kind of comfort, and the fact that these ones were like full of mud is incredible. But yeah, and then in my kit I actually I wore the pretty much the same thing. I didn't really have time to get changed, but I did change from kind of short shorts into three-quarter lengths, and that was just because the brambles were so awful on the new section. But in general, yeah, I sort of feel that's not really what makes you be able to run well, your kit. You know, like it's useful to have shoes that have good grip and that are comfortable, and you need a pack that, yeah, is comfortable that you can get stuff out of, but definitely doesn't need to be new, and being repaired makes no difference whether it's new or not. If it works, then it works. So definitely a supporter of making things last as long as possible.
The same pair of shoes got you through three Barclays.
Yeah.
Has this been something you've known for a while, that you can get a lot more mileage out of gear than maybe is advertised out there? Or has this been an experiment, a work in progress where you've had to learn to trust your gear in recent years?
I think I've always, used them. I guess I have a kind of fell runner mindset, which is that you use things till they fall apart. So I've kind of always done that. And it was nice actually stepping away from being sponsored by a brand, because it meant that I could like really follow that through and, you know, use things till they really fell apart and use them up fully, because I was not being sent a new pair of something. So that's something, I guess, that intrinsically I was just brought up like that. My parents, you know, we didn't buy a lot of stuff if you didn't need it. I'm not hugely into shopping for things.
I have to imagine that probably even before this year's Barkley, but certainly after this year's Barkley, you're probably being inundated with messages from brands, marketers, et cetera, who are saying, you know, we love what you're doing and we would love to affiliate with you, but it sounds like that's something you're kind of shunning. You don't want to affiliate with. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I'd say that I know that I'm in a really fortunate position because, you know, this is, for me, it's just a hobby. I have a full-time job. I'm not financially dependent on the support of companies. So like I'm in no way I'm judging any athlete that is sponsored by a company of any sort. It's just that I'm in the fortunate position to be able to make the decision myself. And for me, especially since having kids, I don't get to travel to, it's not, and actually having decided that I don't want to travel across the world lots. And so I don't do many races. So financially, it's, you know, like we manage it without any sort of sponsorship. So I have that option and I just prefer to be able to be free to make my own decisions. And that's both in terms of, you know, I guess what I want to promote and use my platform for, which I prefer to kind of promote participation in sports, especially for women and girls and the green runners, than any sort of brand sponsorship. So that was my decision to move away from being sponsored by a specific company. And I always find it too stressful anyway, like trying to decide what would be the right company to support without kind of having the depth of knowledge that would be needed for that, even if it was theoretically a eco-friendly company. I found that quite stressful.
So is it fair to say if you do have an affiliation, it would be the Green Runners?
Yeah, I think, that would be fair to say,
And talk about that organization and what it aims to do. And like in a case like this where we're talking post-Barkley and you've grown your audience and you have a chance to send a message, like talk about how that's all organized and kind of what message you want to spread there.
Yeah, thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. So the Green Runners is a group of runners that came together after COP26, just really, I guess, wanting to kind of inspire change more quickly than it was seeing it happen in real life, I guess, and starting within the running community. So the aim is to kind of inform and empower runners to make greener decisions in terms of their running. And it's based on four pillars. How you move, how you kit up, how you fuel, and how you speak out. So very quickly, how you move is your travel, mainly to races, and we know that that's probably 90% of most kind of events. Carbon footprint comes from the travel of participants to races. So generally, traveling to fewer races, traveling more locally if you can use public transport, traveling by land and sea rather than flying, which is obviously the last kind of the thing that you want to try and avoid. And if you are going to fly, then really think about the race and, you know, make it something that really counts and maybe is just maybe once a year or, you know, limit the number of times that you do that. And then how you kit up is an obvious one. So like not buying lots of new kit if you don't need it, trying to repair, reuse, swap kit if it doesn't work for you, but really trying to kind of get good kit that will last you a long time and really keep using it. And then how you fuel is thinking about kind of a more planet-friendly, generally slightly more plant-based diet rather than eating, you know, we know that lots of meat and dairy is not so good for the planet. And then how you speak out, which I think is really important. So the Green Runners have been making kind of and big efforts to speak out in the kind of field of sponsorship in running events. So, you know, they had a campaign to try and get UTMB to dump Dacia as their main sponsor. So that sort of thing, just trying to, because we in trail running is still fairly new to this kind of area of having big sponsors. So I think we still have a say in this as runners in terms of shaping how we want the future of our sport to look.
Where does the campaign around the Dacia status with UTMB stand right now?
So we've had like several conversations with them. I think we've definitely given them a lot of food for thought. I can't say that they currently are dropping Dacia, but then maybe that was always going to be difficult to achieve, given that I think they're signing to a certain contract with them. But what I will say is that I think that maybe we've made an impact in terms of shaping the way other UTMB events sign up for their, you know, choose their sponsors already. So I think there has been some impact there, and maybe that will help, influence the way that UTMB choose future sponsors for their events, because they clearly saw the depth of feeling, in response to that campaign, all across, it was across multiple countries in Europe. So it wasn't just the UK where the Green Run is predominantly, based and started. Lots of other countries, including France, that where it was really kind of big news, that petition. So I think the UTMB are aware of the depth of feeling, and I think we'll have to adapt.
I know you've been really creative and intentional in the past with how you travel to races. I followed your journey to, I think, the 2022 UTMB, similar pattern last year for the World Championships. I know that you were sort of public leading into this year's Barclay about sort of the trade-offs that were involved in terms of, leaving a carbon footprint via air travel, but also if you were successful here, maybe the message that you could spread would sort of counterbalance that footprint. Which I think is all really cool. And I think it's great to get people thinking on that front. But one of the reasons why I'm asking it is, I'm very curious to know if you would ever return to the US, not necessarily for Barclay, but other events. Like, I know Hard Rock has been on your radar. Was this kind of like your last activity in the US for a bit? Could you come back in subsequent years to do more events here? What are you currently thinking?
I mean, I think if I was going to name one race that I would, like one event that I would like to go back to the US for, I think it would be Hard Rock. You're right. So I'm definitely not going to say that I won't do it. My brother also lives in the US. So, you can always combine. Whenever I would go to the US, I see them. We kind of travel via them, my brother and his family. So I guess I would say that I won't rule it out that I would like to go to Hard Rock at some point. But if I do, it would probably be one of those kind of, it'll be a real special occasion in terms of, that will be the focus, and of the year, and that will be the one race. I have a feeling that it's not going to be immediately next year. So it's more that it'll probably build up to it a little bit, and then really kind of really enjoy that moment and that time, and make a big family holiday out of it probably. So that's the other reason that I think we'll wait for a couple of years, maybe till the kids are both at an age where we can go on a kind of proper hiking trip when we're there as well. For a few weeks.
Would you ever do a long trail over here, like the Pacific Crest Trail or the Appalachian Trail?
Yeah. The thing is, you keep mentioning things that I really want to do. So like, I don't know, could you do like, yeah, and then there's time off, isn't there? That's the other thing. But yeah, so that's why I'm not going to say that I'm never going to fly again after this. So, but I think, yeah, I'm sticking to kind of the thought that I want to try and minimize the amount of flying I do. If I do fly, like maximum once a year, and has to be something that I'm kind of really passionate about, that's difficult to replicate in any other form.
We first talked to you, it would have been 2 years ago after your fun run. And then I also know there was a lot of media attention around that. And then prior to that, the spine, when you won that outright, a lot of media attention. There's sort of been those like three waves, this one probably being the biggest. I'm curious to know, like, do you feel more prepared for it this time around? Not that you weren't then, but like, is it something that you're trying to harness strategically for this message about like sort of environmental awareness in action? I'm just, anytime someone kind of like, walks into this major, major spotlight where like the New York Times is, focusing on you, the BBC is focusing on you, I'm always curious about sort of like the reactions to it. So if you don't mind, I'd love to hear kind of your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I do feel better prepared for it than the spine race. After the spine race 5 years ago, I think, in contrast, I felt quite sort of naive and overwhelmed and by it. I'd say that I'm still pretty bad at saying no to requests for things. Like, I'm keen to, feel that I'm maybe inspiring people and able to use that kind of platform to spread the message. I'm sort of still saying yes to everything pretty much. But I do think that I've got better at kind of harnessing this platform. So I actively thought about the fact that if I had this opportunity, how I would best use it. And that was, again, one of the reasons that I kind of stepped away from having a sponsor, because I wanted to use it to promote something that I felt was important to me rather than just being used to promote kind of people buying more kit or whatever that was. So and this time I definitely actively thought, like you mentioned before, about traveling to the US for Barclay. That was definitely an active kind of thought in my head was that if I managed to pull it off, which I had a high degree of like self-belief this year, I thought it could happen. But it was definitely something in my mind was that this is what I was going to do with the opportunity. And I can't say that I've always managed it that well. It's difficult in interviews to steer it towards being asked a question about the Green Runners. And sometimes, and you know, I've managed when they say, is there anything else you want to say? And then I say it, but they don't always include that in the, and often don't include it. They cut it, or they don't include it in the written interview. So there's been some that have and some that haven't, but I guess all you can do is keep trying.
Well, it stuck out to me. Like I said, I was on the ground, and this was pre lap one. So it wasn't even lap 3, 4, 5 in the race when, you know, gear is naturally battered, but I was like, oh, like what are the patches there? Like, there's gotta be a story behind that. The other thing that you mentioned a moment ago was that this was also an opportunity to shine a light on female participation in sports. And I think one of the big things you've wanted to work on is making sure that girls don't drop out of sport too early. And I'm curious, like with your background, was that something that, you know, there were either mentors in your life or just opportunities where you were able to kind of stick with it and be an athlete from childhood until now?
Yeah, I think I was just really lucky to have the upbringing I did with my parents. Like I never really considered myself any different than the boys around me in terms of what I was capable of. I have 3 brothers and I was just, you know, the same as them. In fact, I was actually generally the one that led the way in terms of, like, you know, me and my brother, my oldest brother, who's 15 months young. So I'm the oldest. He's 15 months younger than me. And I was always the one that kind of led the way in terms of endurance things. Like we hiked when I was, I think, 15 and 14 or something like that. We hiked sort of 75 kilometers one day. I just set off in the morning. We just hiked the whole way. And actually, you know, I think my brother sort of like didn't even just the last hill to the home sort of didn't make it up the hill. I hope he doesn't mind me saying this. But and we sort of had to run home to get my parents to kind of collect the last little bit. But like that just kind of shows that we were sort of doing those slightly crazy things even at that age, and just kind of for the fun of it, yeah, for seeing what you could do endurance wise. So, but it was generally me that was leading the way at that point. So I think I never really considered myself any different in terms of what I was capable of. And then that was the same when I sort of started hiking at university with people. I was generally the one that was like happiest to go out earliest and stay out latest in terms of that in the hills. So I always felt like I could do it and I enjoyed it. And so in terms of inspiring girls in sport, I'm just really aware that there is a kind of, there's this big dropout of girls from sport. And I think largely after actually the spine, because I didn't, you know, I just set out to do the spine because I was kind of wanted to do it for me and I was excited about the challenge. Yeah. But then given all the messages that came afterwards about inspiring people, I got a lot of messages, you know, from children and including girls and saying, you know, that you've inspired me and I want to run the spine with you when you're older and that sort of thing. But also messages from their parents saying things like, you know, my little girl came home from school not wanting to do football anymore because of the boys. And then we talked about you, or we looked at, you know, some clips of you, and now she wants to do it again. And she's, you know, and that sort of thing. And, you know, she's really inspired, or she's doing this like race at school or something. And those are the stories that really, you know, kind of touch you and inspire you in return. So I think I was suddenly aware that actually this meant a lot to people, and it was making, doing some good about, in a kind of field that I was really passionate about. So sorry, that was a very long answer. I am passionate about that.
Well, no, and this is a pretty selfish question, but I'm about to be a parent like 5 months from now for the first time.
Oh, congratulations.
And it will be a girl, which is cool. And one thing I've been curious about, and you kind of touched on it, is when you were growing up, there was no differentiation really between how your parents treated your brothers versus you. Do you think that was important? Is that something that more families should consider?
Yeah. I mean, I don't see why you shouldn't do that. You know, I can't really think of anything. I guess if the child has a passion that they want to do, then absolutely encourage them to follow that. But I guess we did a lot of things outside, you know, a lot of hiking, and I guess we cross-country skied and downhill skied and cycled and all these sorts of things. And I guess it makes no difference if you're a girl or a boy. Did a lot of outdoor swimming as children as well, just in lakes and rivers and things like that. So I guess I just had quite an outdoor kind of childhood, and it made no difference whether I was a girl or a boy. And I do think that, yeah, just gave me largely enjoyment of it. You know, I just grew up with like a real love of wild places and being outdoors. And I think that's like the key thing. I think the key thing to sustain in sport is actually just enjoying it and then having the confidence to remain in that environment, I guess, especially if it's male dominated.
You know, one thing we didn't talk about in our last conversation that I just happened to kind of come across in research for this one was that it hasn't been an easy road for you, like in your 20s and 30s. Like, I didn't realize that you have no ACL ligament in your left leg. You've dealt with chronic fatigue issues at certain points. And then obviously there's just demands bouncing back from, you know, being a new parent and stuff like that. Can you speak to any of these experiences and how you sort of triumphed over them? And you know, we're talking now where, you know, you've had success at some of the most impressive multi-day events in the sport, first time finisher for a female at Barclay. I'm really curious. Talk about that if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the knee, I tore my cruciate ligament when I fell off in a riding accident when I was 17. Actually partially tore it, and then I was running for a train and I missed it and I kind of stamped to a halt, and I guess tore the rest of it. And since then I've had a couple of arthroscopies and MRI and things like that. So it's definitely fully gone. But I guess I was just back doing sport quite kind of efficiently by the time I kind of got a diagnosis, and then just never repaired. So it was actually really good for kind of a long time after that. And then it was just in the last maybe 5 years that became kind of more of a problem for me again. So the first two Barclays that I ran, it really wasn't that great. And then this year it just amazingly kind of just got better. I think I did a lot of strength work. I had a physio, project physio in Edinburgh, and they were great. And suddenly it just, like, it's been brilliant. It's been better than it has forever. So I guess it's just the sign that you don't have to give up and think you've got a kind of chronic injury that's going to be with you the rest of your life. Because, you know, the feeling was that maybe I would just need a knee replacement at some point. And now I'm so much more optimistic about it. So it's amazing. And then you're right. It's a challenge. It's a challenge kind of. I'm always aware of kind of when people sort of say, how do I manage it, and kind of super mum and all these sorts of words, and it makes me a bit uneasy, partly because I'm not, I'm just definitely, you know, just normal. And then, you know, but secondly, I worry that people will feel under pressure to kind of do all these things and get up at 5 a.m. and that sort of thing. I guess I just want people to know that it's not like, it's not always easy either. And sometimes I don't manage it and I go through periods when I'm more tired. And yeah, you're right, I had this kind of chronic fatigue and it was kind of low grade. And I feel bad even saying it because people obviously, you know, have much more serious problems. But I don't know if it was after COVID or if it was just a combination of having young children and working full time and trying to run races like Barclay. But yeah, that sort of passed again in sort of November, December time. We were away at Christmas for 2 weeks and I actually went to bed with the kids every night at like 9 o'clock, 8, 9 o'clock, and slept till 8 a.m. till I woke up with a light. And I think that was like the key that finally like knocked it on the head. And I just felt like a new person. So, and this year I came to Barclay feeling like really good, which was a joy.
Talking more specifically about Barclay, I'd love for you to recount the moment. This was probably back in 2019 after you won the spine. I believe you got on Laz's radar as someone who could have the potential to finish the Barclay one day. Recount that moment, because from what I understand, you were still like not totally sold on the race and it took a couple more years of kind of convincing yourself to get there. So I'd love to kind of hear that story some more.
Yeah. And you know, I couldn't even tell you the exact interview that it was, but somebody interviewed Laz, or Laz was, you know, was filmed talking about it. And I think was asked about me doing Barclay and said that he would be keen to see me try Barclay. And then that came fed back to me via several people, at least I was told that. And I guess it planted a seed. And at that point, I still didn't, you know, I knew of Barclay. I sort of vaguely followed it at the time, but I wasn't obsessed by it. And I didn't, frankly, entirely get the idea why people were so kind of keen on running loops in a forest, when the idea just, you know, I guess I run for fun, and the joy of kind of running different places and beautiful mountains and then running loops in a forest seemed like a bit of an odd thing. But it was a bit like the spine, because when I first heard about the spine, I said, you'd have to be crazy to run it, and why would anybody want to put themselves through that? But it was like it sort of grew on me. It was just this idea of whether you can do it, you know, that question in your head, that little voice asking you whether you can do it. With Barclay, there was the extra kind of, I guess the extra sort of temptation bell is sort of like this tantalizing thought of if a woman hasn't done it yet, like, could a woman do it? Because generally, you know, lots of people said a woman couldn't, including Laz, although I'm pretty sure that Laz wanted a woman to do it and thought that maybe, you know, I don't know what he thought, but I think he was hoping that a woman would come out and try and prove him wrong. So it wasn't till my son was born, and then he was, I guess, an infant. I don't know, he was like less than a year old. And then suddenly one day, it was just like in a matter of days, something changed, and suddenly I was like, I want a big challenge, and I know what that challenge is going to be. I want to try and run Barclay. And it was like, I think this happened after my daughter as well with a spine, that suddenly I had something to aim for. And it was like, yeah, it was a fantastic feeling. It's like you have something to focus on and something to get fit for again. And I think after having a child, then that's like a really good motivation to kind of get you fully fit again, is if you sign up for something bigger than you think you can do. And it's like, it's suddenly, it's a whole new, gets you all excited about running again. Because it is difficult to come back when you've been fit and like race fit and like competing kind of at the, you know, I guess fairly high level, and then to stop and like be pregnant and have a child and you lose it all. So you go right back. But then to sort of to get back into it, it's really good to have something that really excites you and sort of fires you up. And Barclay was like that. Suddenly I knew I wanted to do it. And I knew that beforehand that I needed to feel like that before I could go, because there wasn't any point in going otherwise. Because from what everybody said and from what I understood, you need to be sort of fully committed. And I would definitely agree with that now, having been there.
I have some questions to follow up on that. But one thing I have to tell you as an aside, even in camp over those 3 days, I didn't hear it from Laz, but because I actually think he secretly really wanted you to finish. He was really in his heart pulling for you, kind of like you said. But I was hearing all this chatter from various people that what you were about to do was impossible, that all the math, the logic, the science, the equations, the algorithms, like every time they would run the numbers, it would come back saying, you know, Jasmine has no chance, women have no chance at this event. So it was extra sweet to see that narrative die instantly when you touched the gate. And I didn't take a moment to kind of look around and try to like identify the people that were saying that, but it was, because I try not to be too vindictive, but like it was awesome to see.
Thank you.
So I had to kind of say that as an aside. But coming back to what you said, like with the application essays, one thing I'm curious about with what you just said there about kind of like the total commitment, was that what you tried to communicate in your applications to Laz?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the first time I wrote like a kind of, I guess like a kind of from the heart, kind of more detailed, and like, yeah, like that sort of thing. And I guess explaining a bit about where I'm coming from, I guess my love of wild places and wilderness and the kind of my background of it. I guess I said what I'd, just trying to kind of, I guess, give him an idea of who I was. Like, you know, I mentioned like as a child doing things like when we were kind of hiking, so we sort of dropped for the kind of, for the adventure, I guess. And sort of, yeah, that's my background, is kind of running in wild places. I'm a fell runner, so I'm used to sort of navigating across open hillside and kind of finding my way, and I guess not necessarily having kind of support stations with lots of food and kind of people crewing you and that sort of thing. I'm used to that sort of self-sufficiency. So I don't know, I sort of kind of tried to put that across, both the kind of my background, my love of wild places, and the fact that I was really keen to test myself against this kind of challenge that he'd created. And then in subsequent years, it sort of got a lot, like I got more concise because he knew me. And this year I included something along the lines of, you know, the first year I ran a fun run in 40 hours, the second year I ran it in 36. And I said, Laz, if I run it in 32 this year, then that'll give me 28 hours to run the last two loops, and I reckon that that's doable. And then I did run it in like about 32. So I like stuck to the game plan, and when it came to it.
One last break to mention a new partner that I am really excited about. and that is Delta G ketones. You've heard me talk about and support the use of ketones in performance settings like ultramarathons many times over the last couple of years. I've personally included exogenous ketones in my own training and racing during that stretch. And after taking roughly 6 months to do more research in this area of nutrition, particularly since last August, what turned me on to Delta G was that its products allow individuals to achieve deep states of ketosis safely and immediately in both performance and recovery contexts. I'll have much more to add about how and why I use Delta G in future episodes, but one of the biggest reasons I support this company is because it's got the only products out there that get individuals to achieve these beneficial levels of ketosis safely. So if you're interested and you want to check out their range of products, I encourage you to visit their website, deltagketones.com. And if you end up making a purchase, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order. Awesome. Awesome. You know, I remember kind of coming back to this theme of total commitment and total preparation. I think the last time we talked, you were saying that in your training for this race, friends, family, community, they set up these like mock Barkley marathon courses in your local Fell area. Was that something that you recreated this time around, like in 2024?
Yeah. My mom, so I'm half Czech. So, we were there over kind of the Christmas period. And my mum actually set up a kind of a mini Barkley near home. And I think I had a kind of metatarsal stress fracture actually in November, December, but I was running again by Christmas. And so I actually ran three loops of it, but I was really keen that we run five in total. So I ran one on my own, and then I ran one with comrade, and then I ran one with my brother. So in total, we did five, and I changed the directions as well. So it was, so we did five loops of the course, and that included books hidden in places and everything. It was fantastic. Mm. And then, and then I had some like friends set up some navigation for me here in the hills, which I actually screwed up quite impressively, but still it was good, kind of it was a good reminder of kind of the skills that I just kind of a good kind of kick in the teeth, I guess, in terms of reminding you about what you're doing when you're navigating. So I did that in the run up to Barkley as well, so that was all useful. So it was like it feels like a kind of group project, this whole Barkley thing, because I've had like several Barkleys set up by friends and family in preparation over the years, and so it's like the culmination of everyone's efforts.
It's one of the coolest simulations out there that I've heard of. You know, you go back on Strava retroactively to look at, you know, John Kelly's training or Joe McConaughey's training, etc., maybe Jared Campbell. A lot of it, maybe they might pick a certain peak in their local backyard and lap it excessively, you know, for whatever, 12 to 24 hours. And that'll be one of the peak things. But to actually take the time to, you know, have like a variation of a book and to create this, you know, the actual lap, it's awesome. That I don't know if that's going to be surpassed by future participants in terms of prep. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
One thing, you know, again, I was fortunate to be there, and I got to see, I don't want to call them theatrics, but it was just this amazing moment, you know, in the lap 4 to 5 transition. Mm-hmm. I know that you've spoken with a number of members of the media about sort of that interaction with Jared. We actually just had Jared on the podcast to talk about it. But one thing I'm curious about, like once you had left camp and you were on lap 5, like in that first maybe hour to 2 hours post leaving camp, talk about sort of what was going through your mind and how you were collecting yourself. Cause I know that it was a pretty low moment, you know, you were struggling to get food down, stuff like that. So I'm just amazed at how you were able to get from that state to then having the power to, you know, really put together a miracle on lap 5.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Jared's kind of, you know, offer to allow me to run, you know, to give me the opportunity to run clockwise. And that in itself was like a huge kind of motivation and like a huge positive push, I guess. It really helped at the start of that fifth loop because it sort of felt like a big hug really, in terms of, and it also made it more, gave me an extra chance to do it. And so I felt like, you know, come on, everybody's wants it, you know, it felt like there was a kind of real community desire for me to do it. So it felt really, I felt really positive and kind of buoyed by that. And then I think, you know, I ate my banana and I kind of wobbled down the track a bit. And then once I started climbing, I was like, you know, I actually said to myself out loud, come on, you know, I did quite a bit of talking to myself, woke myself up. And I guess the adrenaline just sort of started to set in. And I think because I was doing it on my own, and it became clear to me that like I couldn't make any mistakes, although I did actually make one kind of fairly decent mistake. It cost me 15-20 minutes, but I sort of like, you know, this is your chance to prove it to the world. And I guess the adrenaline kicked in, the excitement of doing it on my own and wanting to do it right, and also like critically, I think the knowledge that you were doing it for the last time, because that's one of the big challenges of Barclay, is that you have to keep going up these same hills. And the first time it's kind of fun, and the second time it's okay still. And then the third time you feel terrible, and you still know that you've got to do it two more times. But by the time you get to the last leap, you know that, you know, like you get to the top of this hill and then you're like, goodbye, I've done it, I'm not coming back. And then you're like, you know, so I think that's like a really, really bonus, because every time you go through somewhere on the fifth leap, you know that you're doing it for the last time. And so that it helps to kind of, again, positively reinforce that sort of motivation driving you forward. And I just started to, I guess as time went on, I became more and more sort of aware of the time. Like at the start, it took me a little while to get sort of rolling. But as certainly by the time I'd passed John Kelly, I was really thinking about the time down to the minute. And I that's when I sort of started thinking I can do this, but it's going to be really tight. And then I've talked a lot about the next bit in terms of kind of racing the clock to get back.
I think what you described there, which was perfect, was something that I only got to observe, you know, sporadically when we saw you on top of Frozen Head Mountain, going up and down Ratchaw at camp. But like that real crux of the race to me seems to just be the general mental load of Barclay, and how on every single lap, you're guaranteed to run into setbacks. You're almost guaranteed, even if you're a veteran, to make mistakes. And yeah, like, and I think what you just described are like some awesome strategies for staying resilient. And I, maybe with this year, it was attaching sort of like a finality to the race. But was there anything else? Like, is there anything else kind of in your playbook for how you can cope and just like stay present and still optimistic that you're going to get things done?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of touch on a few things there, because staying present is a big thing. It's very easy, especially in the warm sunshine, when you're on your own in the forest, to forget how urgent the situation is, you know. So you have to almost have to keep telling yourself, and keep, you know, I was on the last leap, I was sort of setting myself time limits, especially from the fire tower back. I had it like down to the minute of where I needed to be at what time. And at that point, I was like, I don't know, I was like trying to go, you know, going, climbing up from the prison at the bottom. I was like telling myself, you need to be moving your legs faster. And I was like trying to chant in my head, and just chanting the name of my names of family members. And it was like I was chanting them sort of really like emphatically, like they were like pushing me up the hill. Like each time I said one name, it was like pushing me. So I was doing it quite fast so that I would be moving my legs fast, and so that I would keep up with the chant in my head. And so that was just like something to kind of keep me motivated and moving. But it's a case of constantly reminding yourself how urgent the situation is. And the time that I did make this, the one kind of significant mistake that I made that cost me maybe 15-20 minutes, and John Kelly I think made the same mistake and also cost him about 15 minutes in the new section. It's kind of trying not to panic, trying to keep your head about you to work it out, rather than just running around headlessly like a kind of headless chicken. Because in my case, I just needed to work out. I dropped down to the river in the wrong place, and it was the case of like, do I go up river or down river in terms of working out which way to go to try and find the book. I did, but it wasn't perfect. It could have been a bit quicker than it was.
We did a brief interview with you at the gate shortly after you completed the fifth lap. And, you know, I was struck by how lucid and with it you were, sort of describing your initial feelings about what this meant and how you were going to kind of use the moment. One thing that blew me away though, and you sound great now, but like your voice was totally gone. And it was one of the most visible examples of how hard you had worked. Is that something you've dealt with in the past? Like how early or late into the race was that sort of a symptom of how hard you were working?
I think I still had a voice when I went out to loop five, or that I just, like, I guess I was just feeling a bit terrible, so I didn't really speak much, but I still had a voice then. And I still had a voice when I talked to John Kelly, who when we passed each other, which was, I guess, I was a bit less than halfway. He was a bit more than halfway in his loop type thing.
Yeah.
I think what happened after that was, as I say, at some point then I realized how tight it was for time. And essentially what I was doing then turned into a tempo run, like, you know, wasn't tempo run pace for your standard pace of a tempo run, but 60, you know, once you've been in running Barkley for 54 hours or something, then relatively speaking, it was a tempo run. And because it's quite dry and because, you know, I guess I wasn't drinking or eating that much, I think just the fact that I was breathing hard through my mouth and kind of dry air and had been already for like 2 days and not really kind of taking on that much liquid or food, I think it was those things that just must have done something to my kind of voice, vocal cords. And then obviously the final kind of kilometer when I was breathing like a kind of train, trying to run up the hill, sprinting up the hill. And I think I was hypoglycemic probably as well. And it was a combination of everything. And also my chest had, I was coughing quite badly, I think already on loop two. And then, so I guess my chest wasn't that great. So by the time I get to the end, I was probably, it was a combination of things. But I think the vocal cords was just that. It was just breathing really hard for that kind of 6 hours, which you wouldn't usually do. You might do that for like an hour at most, but not for that long.
Just a few more questions for you. And this is more, I guess, philosophical in nature. But one thing I was thinking about sort of after seeing you finish and then just reflecting the past few days is how someone like you might sort of cope with the aftermath of hitting your goal and realizing the end of an obsession. And it makes me wonder, like in your case, do you get a sense of nostalgia about the effort that was involved? And do you immediately start to wonder if there's something else out there to transfer that to in the future? Like, is it running related? Is this like the closing of a chapter and you kind of focus on family, or like, how are you currently thinking about this?
You know, maybe that's changed a little bit since I had kind of kids, because now it was actually just, it was nice to get back. Firstly, the media kind of has been quite overwhelming. At the end, I was already actually at work at the end of last week already, just doing my research things. And I commuted from nursery to the lab on my bike, like I always do, listen to my music. And that was actually the best bit of the day, because I had a moment to think about what had happened. And it was really wonderful. Like, you know, I kind of get a really warm feeling inside. I think because I gave it everything as well, you know, I like left it all out there, like more than any race I've ever done before. So it sort of felt like it was, yeah, it's a closing of a chapter, but like I'm so happy with what I did because I gave it everything, that I'm fine with that. But in answer to your question, I think having children has changed it, because before I might have felt more sad, I guess a bit of anticlimax, because it was such a kind of build up and it was such a big thing, that now it's sort of, things are starting to settle down a bit. Would you feel a sense of anticlimax? But I think having kids is like the perfect antidote to that, because for them, I'm just, you know, I'm just mum. And even when I came back, my little girl was excited that some friends had said they'd see me on the telly at school. But that was, you know, that was brief, and then it's forgotten. And my 3-year-old, he doesn't have any concept of that yet at all, really. So for them, I'm just mum, and it's just about bed, you know, stories or what we're going to do that day, whether we're going to go swimming or paddling outside by the kind of pool reservoir. So that just brings you back into real life and gives you a real sense of perspective. And for them, for me, they're always the most important thing. So my family. So I certainly dream and have these kind of big ambitions and dreams and kind of love to have these adventures, but ultimately I'm coming back to the thing that I love most in the world. So that's a really good kind of grounding thing. I think the one thing that I am already nostalgic for is kind of the Barkley family, which I think that's what they would call themselves, is just, you know, I've been there 3 years, and it's been really nice coming back to those same people, because there's a core of people that are there every year, and this year I really felt it. And we actually ran as quite a big group for the first half of loop one. It was actually 20 people for the first half, probably, or at least third of group of loop one. And it felt like a bit of a party, you know. And then even, you know, the camp beforehand and afterwards, and I think especially with it being kind of such, it felt so joyous at the end as well, that I think that's the thing that I'll miss. And you know, beforehand we went for brunch at John Kelly's with a group of people, and we've done that last year as well, and I met Ihor, and it was so nice to have friends there. And I think that's what I'm going to miss more than kind of doing the race. It's just that kind of atmosphere and those people. But I hope that we can meet in other places, and I imagine we will at some point.
Very cool. Very cool. maybe the last question. You know, we talked earlier about hard rock and some US-based projects. Are you currently interested in continuing investing in sort of these multi-day events? And if so, are there any on your short list that you'd want to approach in, you know, the rest of 2024, or 2025 and beyond?
Yeah, so I guess the next thing I've kind of got of that sort of nature is the Tour de Gio, which so I think it's pretty well known. So it's like a long race in Italy. I think it's 330 kilometers, maybe a lot of 1,000 meters of ascent, and 20 something thousand meters of ascent. It's a race that, you know, Damien and John Kelly have been to several times, and I think Sebastian's won the Tour of Glaciers a couple of times. So it's like, it's one of the kind of classics, and from what I understand, it's got a great atmosphere, and, you know, it's a beautiful route and kind of fantastic mountains. So I've run parts of that just on, you know, on holiday in the Alps. So that's the next kind of big race.
You'll do that this September?
Yeah.
Cool. I realize it's so silly of me to even ask what's next after such a monumental feat, but such is the nature of trail running media. Very cool. Jasmine, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. We really appreciate your time. I always give guests the final word. Is there anything that you want to leave listeners with, any thoughts or calls to action before we go?
I guess I'd say thank you to everybody so much for kind of all the support that I've had. I run in the mountains because I love wild places. It makes me just happy. It gives me kind of perspective and peace. And I hope that others can enjoy that. And I, in terms of Barclay and what I did, I hope that, I hope that I can inspire other people to guess if you want to achieve something, if you have some dreams, then not to kind of hold back, to give it a try and to put everything into it, and you'll be surprised about what's possible. And then I guess the final thing would be to say, if you are interested in kind of finding out more about the Green Runners, we're at thegreenrunners.com, and have a look there, have a think, and if you do want to kind of get involved or maybe become a member, then it's just a case of making a pledge of something that you're going to do to try and lessen the impact of your running on the environment, and then signing up and becoming a member.